morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Show Ali, Nick Ashbourne filling in for Blake Murphy, who is indeed back tomorrow, Thursday. Blake being, I think, wisely load managed down the stretch, but until tomorrow, Nick Ashbourne and I are here for your listening pleasure. Nick, how's it going?
Excellent. Good to be with you again. We're finishing our run here, but we're going to be back again this weekend with Jays Talk, so the combination will keep on rolling.
That is true. It's true. I often like to make the comparison that you and I are maybe like the, we're like the Ryan Yarbroughs of the Jays Talk rotation. Eat some innings, come in, maybe throw some quality innings.
Sometimes we can get above 87 miles per hour. Like, I wouldn't sell
maybe
us that
can.
Short.
Maybe but. You can. I don't know about me, but no, I do appreciate doing this with you. We'll be joined a little bit later on in the hour by Thomas Hall, the Jays Nation. He's going to join us in studio. And at the top of the next hour from MLB.com, columnist for MLB.com, it's Will Leach. Maybe we'll get some TIFF recommendations from Will. He's a big movie guy as well, which I am very much looking forward to. So maybe we'll do that at the end of that conversation. But Thomas Hall, Will Leach, our guests today. Why don't we start with the Bo Bichette discussion, Nick? Because I feel like we saw Bo on TV yesterday for the first time in ages. Like, it indeed confirmed to me that Bo is, in fact, still a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. And we had not seen him for quite some time. It is pretty funny to think about how wildly the perception of both Bo and Vladdy have changed year over year. Like, if we were having this exact conversation about who do you re-sign, who do you trade, I would almost guarantee that the perception of both would have been completely flipped. It would have been a re-sign Bo to a several hundred million dollar contract. It would have been trade Vladdy or let him walk in free agency. And now we're completely on the other side, right? It's signed Vladdy to a contract that starts with a 3, maybe a 3.5, for example, if it's 350 or something even higher than that, $1 million. And it's a trade Bo for spare parts. It's wild how much a year's difference can make.
Yeah, coming out of last season, Vladdy had just had an okay year at the plate, like slightly above average, but for a first baseman, to be honest, not that much above average. And you would have said, okay, we're going to build the team for the future. Who do we want to build around? Let's build around the guy who plays a premium position. And I know that Bo's defensive ability has been questioned a lot, but realistically, you could put him at second base. He probably would have thrived there. And when you're thinking about, a foundational guy for your team for, 10 years, potentially, given how young these guys are, you don't often think of it being the first baseman. And Bo had also been so consistent on a year-to-year basis. Like, there'd be months and weeks where Bo looked out of sorts or he looked unbelievable. But it always felt like at the end of the year, you look at his baseball card, probably not literally a baseball card because we're moving away from that a little bit here in the 2020s. But you look at whatever, his baseball reference page, and it was almost the same. Like, he was a metronome, realistically. And Vladdy, there had been so much variance. It's like, how do you invest in a guy over a 10-year span when there's so much variance? And now Vladdy has kind of shown you, okay, I can do 2021 again. I'm not sure if he's going to do that every single year, but you know that was not a fluke. He has shown you that again. And then Bo has had serious durability issues and just performance issues. Like, when he's been there, you could argue whether he's been fully healthy or not at any given time. But when he's been on the field, he has not performed this season.
First of all, before we continue this conversation, I take it that means you have never been a huge baseball card collector, or maybe you were when you were younger?
There was a time when I had a couple of shoeboxes of quite old baseball cards that I didn't even really know. Like, okay. Like, they were from before my own time, so I don't think I treated them particularly well. There might have been a moment of potential profit there that I let slide past, but that happens all the time. There's lots of opportunities that are going to pass you by in life.
I only ask because I actually did very briefly during the pandemic consider getting back into card collecting, only to realize that during the pandemic, that might have been the worst possible decision because the value of, they were already kind of expensive to buy like new hobby boxes and so on, but my God, they're expensive. Like, it is not an affordable hobby anymore. Considering like when you were younger, you could buy like, and I know Tim Hortons does this to a certain extent with the hockey cards where you can like buy coffee and get like the cards in the pack, for example. And that was more common when we were younger. You could buy some bubble gum or whatever and take a card out of the pack, but you can't really do that anymore.
It is a wild thing to get into from a cost benefit point of view. It's just sometimes the value of these cards skyrocket and triple and quadruple, and you're like, this is the best investment anyone could have made. And then sometimes there'll just be a day where people are like, yeah, these are pieces of cardboard and actually they're not worth anything, and there'll be huge crashes. it's a volatile game if you're doing it from that perspective. I think it's fun to just have a bunch of cards in a book or something like that. But yeah, trying to use it to make money, yeah, it's worked for some people, hasn't worked for others.
To your point about the volatile nature of cards, I do think what happens with Bobichet and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. are certainly going to make their cards be valued quite differently going forward because, and again, like you said, you used the word metronome to describe Bo, and it's very true. Like, I almost feel like the last, let's call it year, because he got injured. He had the quad injury at the end of last season around this time, I would say. It was like around late August, I think maybe beginning of September when he had the quad injury. So we're basically about a year removed from the first, I would say, major injury of Bo's career. He'd been quite durable before that. And then the quad injury, if you remember, Nick, it happened at the Rogers Center. I don't only remember because I was at that game watching, and he takes the turn around the base, and then he kind of stops. And I think everyone in the stadium was holding their breath because it looked a lot worse than it was. But since then, he has essentially not been the same guy. I mean, he was injured. And then in the offseason, I remember him talking to the media, and it really did feel like Bo was going out of his way to take a leadership role by saying things like, you know, saying all the right things to the media. And I do 100% believe he meant it when he said he wants to be the version of himself he was for most of last year or most of his career all year this season. He was doing different things to stay healthier. And it's kind of unfortunate because he's had a miserable year, no doubt. But I can't help but think at least a large chunk of it is due to the fact that he's been injured in ways that he'd kind of never been injured before. Like he had neck spasms earlier this year, which can be very painful. It can prevent you from even moving your head from side to side, much less like moving around as a shortstop on a baseball diamond. He's had, I think, three separate calf strains this year, which, again, for any professional athlete, is really debilitating. But even for a shortstop and even for a swinger at the plate, for example, a batter at the plate, so taking those swings, and especially for someone like Bo, whose swing has so many different components to it with the legs and the way he moves his body. So I can't help but think that maybe even as soon as next year, Bo and everyone else might look back on this season and say, boy, what a miserable year, but like I'm back to normal. And I think that's why I find it difficult to 100% commit to the idea that Bo should not be a Blue Jay. But we've heard so many reports that they're going to at least shop him. So I do wonder what that means for him going forward.
With Vladdy, there have been so many breadcrumbs about he wants to be there. The team wants to build around him. You know, he's such a great face of the franchise, too. If you think of kind of marketability and off-field stuff, Vladdy kind of checks all those boxes. Whereas Bo has been a little bit more reserved. I don't think his personality comes out as much in the media, but In terms of on the field, like, yeah, in 2021, 159 games. In 2022, 159 games. Last season, 135 games. Like, even that with a little bit of an injury, that's durability. And now this year, it has just been a lost season from a health perspective. And that is difficult when you're trying to market yourself for one of these massive, you know, maybe not face of the franchise contracts, but, you know, because of his age and his position and his performance in the past, like this is a huge deal he's kind of angling for. And he used to be able to say, look, I show up every single day and I play the game, whether that's the right thing or not. Like you could argue from a, you know, player performance perspective, maybe it's not a good idea to have guys play 159 games. Sure, yeah. Maybe he'll go down as a case study for that not being a good idea. But that used to be part of his appeal. Like we've seen for the Blue Jays on the pitching side with guys like Barrios and Gausman and Bassett, a big part of why the team targeted those guys is because they had that durability and reliability. And when you're signing long, long-term contracts, that matters a ton. And that's worth a lot of money. And Bo can no longer go to the market and say, I'm a guy that you can count on in that way, even if maybe he is. Like maybe he will be that right in the future. But because it, you know, there's been, like you said, a little bit of rumors that they're shopping him, rumors that he doesn't necessarily want to be there, and them making that commitment to him is just more and more difficult, especially because of what Vladdy, he should be the guy they prioritize based on performance. He's commanding more and more and more. There's only so much to go around. Like the avenue to the Blue Jays re-signing Bo Bichette is not firmly closed, but it's narrow. We're looking at a one-way street with cars parked on it, and it's going to be difficult to navigate that.
I can't help but think that the best thing for both Bo and the team would be for Bo to play this year. And initially I thought to myself, I mean, was there a point, like if he was going to start the season as a Blue Jay, then I don't think it really matters, right? Like if he's for sure, if they know in the front office, even if the front office doesn't change, And I know many fans want that. But let's say, for the sake of this conversation, it's Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins running the show again to start the season. And unfortunately, I think that seems pretty, I think that seems exceedingly likely at this point, barring something really massive in the offseason. But let's just say, again, for the sake of argument, that they are running the show. So you go into the offseason, you make all the moves we've discussed ad nauseum about the free agent market and the trade market and so on, but you make those moves with the knowledge that Bo is not going to be traded and you enter the season next year. If that is like your plan of attack, and obviously things arise that you can't plan for, but if that is your plan of attack, then it doesn't really matter if Bo plays or not, because it means he can at least, I'm going to use the word I used with you yesterday, in air quotes, rehabilitate, not necessarily his play, but maybe just even just his image in a sense. It doesn't really matter because he's going to be a Blue Jay and he can rehabilitate that certainly over the course of the spring, but in the early start part of the season, in the lead up to next year's trade deadline, which is obviously a good chunk of the season. So it won't really matter. But if you are in fact going into this offseason with the idea that you are not going to start next year with Bo Bichette, a Toronto Blue Jay, then I almost feel like it's imperative that you play him a little bit, right? And again, we've talked a million times, Nick, about how a 2-week sample size is not nearly enough to judge. But I mean, I do think it's different when the two-week sample size is for a player like Will Wagner, for example, or as a player for like Davis Schneider, for example, who are younger, they're unproven at the major league level. Bo has done, in my opinion, I don't know where you're on this, but I think in my opinion, he's done enough that even though he has had a purely miserable season, he's been injured a lot recently, I think if he shows that he's anywhere close to being himself, I honestly wonder if you're trading him, because obviously I can't imagine any team that's trading for him is going to trade for him like without at least offering him some kind of deal, right? Because you really want to give up a lot of assets for Bo if he's just going to walk in free agency anyways, I would imagine no. So you got to think that at least part of that conversation comes with the chat of a long-term extension. I got to think that, you know, if he plays well enough, any team acquiring him would feel a little more comfortable about giving him the, I don't know, I'm going to throw an example, like the Lindor deal, the Turner deal, the Swanson deal, like the deal that most shortstops get, essentially.
Yeah, there is an aspect of him confirming what we already know about right. him. And we don't, as you point out, kind of comparisons to, say, Will Wagner, we don't have that baseline of what we already know. So this small sample is all we have to go on, and that's why we probably need to be cautious. I'm sure we'll talk about Will Wagner later. But with Bichette, if he comes in and for, I don't know, a month or 3 weeks has the quality of contact he normally has and looks, you know, significantly better than he's looked at the plate this season, moves around relatively well, like how's his lateral movement? How is he running the bases? If he looks like vintage Bo Bichette, the fact that he's been so consistent in the past really helps his case. People can say, okay, I know that Bo has had a lost season for the most part. I know that when I look at the baseline results at the end of the year, they are not going to look like that star level player that right. he's been in the past. There's kind of, unless he has sort of one of the Vladdy streak that Vladdy just had, it's just not going to look like that at the end of the day. But they can say, we've seen for the last month or so that he is the guy that he has been year in and year out. And to some degree, he has lost some value already. Like if he had had the season this year that he'd had in the previous couple of seasons right. and you took him to the trade market on that, you would get more than you'll get almost basically regardless of what he does from here on out. Like there is some of it cannot be rehabilitated, but some of it can. And if teams are trading for Bo Bichette to be their shortstop, even if it's just for 1 year, you know, maybe it's a really big market team that has enough money to say, you know, we can wait a year and we know we can compete in the market anyway, so we'll see what we have.
That's fair.
Maybe that's what it is. But they want to know, like, this is a player we're trading for to be an above average starter for that, for us. And it would be helpful for us to see a little bit of that. I don't think they need to see that much of it, but it's helpful for the team, the players, even the Blue Jays making their plans for next year, if they do plan to go ahead with Bo, having a little bit of a better sense of how he projects in 2025.
And, you know, you've brought this up a couple of times with the idea that, you know, as we discuss the idea of auditions for 2025 being the main thing we discuss between now and the end of September, then, you know, at least a part of it is just knowing what you have on the roster, certainly from new players, but certainly from existing players as well. I mean, it's happening in the bullpen. It's happening in the starting rotation. We'll talk about Yariel Rodriguez a little bit later on and what his future could look like. But, I mean, it even applies to Vlad to a certain extent, right? I mean, it's not in the sense of will he produce going forward, but, you know, we've had the conversation about third base for Vladdy a lot. And so, you know, can you get by with Vladdy playing 5 days a week, 6 days a week at third base? I don't know that the answer to that question is a slam dunk yes, but I also don't know that they even know the answer to that question, whether it is a yes or a no, period. So if you're trying to find that out, essentially, then that is what the rest of the season is for. Certainly along the same lines, it's for Bo Bichette, it is simply, can he be healthy and can he be anything resembling what he has been? Do you think Bo is a shortstop long-term, though? Like, do you think that's much like the Vladdy at third base or first base questions? I do wonder if teams looking to acquire Bo are at least having that internal conversation, because we've talked about this a couple of times on Jays Talk. I've talked about it on Jays Talk for ages. It feels like people are asking, well, you know what, Bo, you know, maybe at best, like a fine defensive shortstop, an average defensive shortstop, you're really getting the value from Bo with his bat. And because you didn't get either of those things this year, he's become a below average player. But, you know, I do wonder how many teams trading for him are reticent to hand him the big money deal that most, if not all, even decent shortstops command on the open market, when maybe his future might be at second base, for example.
The contract is really the part of this that matters, right? Like, once a team has Bo Bichette and they have locked him in, then it's very easy to be like, you know what? We're not actually getting the defensive value at shortstop here. We're going to move him to second base. We have another alternative we think works better. And if he's locked in with a team for, I don't know, 7-8 years, something like that, I don't think that will sort of ruin the relationship. Part of what happened with the Blue Jays and Bo Bichette and shortstop is that they were always kind of working towards what is the next contract for Bo going to look like. And as a result, there was a little bit of push and pull of, is he a shortstop? Is there a way to move him? Can we bring in someone good enough to justify moving him? And if we do move him, is that going to tarnish our relationship with the player? Like, he undoubtedly wants to play shortstop, the same way that go into a bullpen and ask any reliever if they'd like to start. They'd love to start because they make more money doing that. Part of it is pride too. I don't want to say it's all just dollars and cents and it's what he grew up doing. And there's more to it than money, but money is the big part of it. So when money gets out of the way, then I think it'll be much easier for teams to explore that aspect of it. That's why trading for Bo Bichette is an interesting proposition, because you are potentially looking at that contract and, are you paying that massive shortstop contract? It's a good question. I do think you can get by with Bo as your shortstop. I think that it is difficult to find a starting caliber shortstop or a guy at that position who brings as much overall value as Bo. There's some people who seem to believe that if you have a shortstop who has some defensive warts, then that's going to compromise your whole team or your whole defense. I don't think it's disqualifying, but especially as he gets a little bit older too, you know, we're talking about a player in his mid-20s right now. I think there's at least going to be contingency plans on, we're going to sign Bo and maybe he's a shortstop for the next 3 years of our 8-year contract, but the longer term plan is to move him presumably to second base. That could be part of it, but it's going to be very difficult. It's a very murky part of what his next contract looks like.
I think too, it's important to remember, because again, I think I am probably more bullish on Bo recapturing his previous form than most, but I do think it's important to remember, and this is a conversation that can apply to a lot of players. It is certainly by no means limited to Bo, but I mean, we've kind of had this conversation about Vladdy for most of the season, but you know, with a lot of these younger guys, at the very least, it's not as though their story is done being told. I mean, you have to look no further than another shortstop that has been much maligned until maybe even just like, what, this year? In Francisco Lindor. Remember when Lindor signed that deal with the Mets? God, people thought it was like one of the worst deals. I think, I'm pretty sure I read articles that it's like it was one of the worst signings in like the history of the franchise, and that it's going to age incredibly poorly, and maybe it still could, I suppose, because he signed for a long time. But Francisco Lindor, like, there are conversations that he could be like the MVP, he could be the NL MVP if Shohei Ohtani didn't exist, which is a common refrain, right? Because Shohei Ohtani does Ohtani things, but it's just pretty wild to think that that's how quickly that conversation turned. And Lindor was a little bit older than Bo, right? So, I'm not saying that all of a sudden in the next couple of years, Bo is going to guaranteed turn to what Lindor has been recently. But I think it just goes to show that, you know, like, growth is never really linear. And that it's not a baseball thing. That's a sports thing. That's really a life thing, actually, if you want to be philosophical about it. But I think when it comes to a lot of these younger players, it's important to keep that in the back of your mind.
Another name that's worth bringing up is Marcus Semien. Like, this is a guy who, as a shortstop, really graded way below average. Like, there was a time where people thought, oh man, Semien is a terrible shortstop. Right. And his bat kind of kept him there, and people thought he had the physical tools to do it and it was going to come together. And eventually it did. And he became like quite a decent defensive shortstop. And then he moved to second base, and he was so good there that he kind of recouped the defensive value from moving from second base, moving from shortstop to second base. And so guys can get better. To be fair, defense, if you look at kind of the aging curve for defense, guys tend to peak early because defense is a lot about athleticism and reaction time and things like that. So most players like Bo Bichette's age, you know, talk about a 26-year-old shortstop, are not going to get much better on defense. But it can be done. There are cases of it happening. Even in Bichette's career, if you look at sort of his advanced stats on the fielding side, he's gotten much better in 2023 than he was in 2022. And in 2024, he actually is relatively okay. Again, not fantastic, but better. And so there is a world where Bichette improves defensively and, you know, justifies that component of his contract. It's hard to say right now, and this is a very weird time to be like, Bo Bichette's going to get so much better on defense when he's been a bit of a physical wreck in recent months. But it is an outcome that's on the table.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Still some time for the rest of the show. We're here until 12 p.m. Eastern. I don't know why I said still some time. There's lots of time left.
It doesn't shortage of time.
You're certainly not pressed for time. To text us at 590-590, name and location. That is the People's Text Line. It is always open. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. You can shoot us a message there if you want to comment on the Bo Bichette discussion, if you want to comment on certainly what went down last night on the win streak, how you feel about the Blue Jays. 590-590, name and location. Let's step aside, Nick, and on the other side, we'll be joined in studio by Thomas Hall from the Jays Nation. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus. Sho and Nick with you on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sho Ali, Nick Ashbourne. We're filling in for Blake Murphy. Blake's back tomorrow. Joining us in studio right now, Thomas Hall from the Jays Nation. Thomas, how are you?
I'm doing good, guys. How are you guys doing?
We're great. I appreciate you coming in studio. We've had many conversations, Thomas, but this is the first time we're actually meeting face-to-face, so it's kind of fun to have you in person with us.
No, it's awesome. I love that I'm actually able to come in studio with these guys. It's so cool.
Well, I appreciate you making the trek down here. I know the trek down into the downtown core is not the friendliest, as we know, Nick.
Yeah, at the best of times.
That's how it is for me literally every day, so I'm glad you're here, Thomas. We were actually just having the conversation before we brought you on the first segment about Bo Bichette and what happens with Bo going forward. Is it worth having him play at shortstop if another team is looking to acquire him? You know, does he want to be a Toronto Blue Jay? I think it's hard to know that for sure without like getting into his mindset. But I don't know. I wonder what you think of the whole Bo Bichette saga, because it does feel like one way or another, it's probably going to come to an end this offseason.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, like they're two different topics, obviously, whether or not he's going to be back next year, whether you want him to come back for the rest of this season. I think, honestly, given the year he's had, I'd love to see him come back, even if only for a couple of weeks, just to give him a bit of a runway to go into the offseason, hopefully healthy, so he doesn't have to have an entire winter of just rehabbing. And so hopefully he can hit the ground running when spring training comes in 2025, whether or not that's with the Blue Jays or another organization.
Yeah, it's going to be a situation where, again, whether he's showcasing for the Blue Jays next year, showcasing for another team, this amount of time is going to be important. And if I'm another team and I'm thinking of getting into the Bo Bichette business, that is a risky proposition right now. And for years and years and years, it seemed like it wouldn't be. It's like, this is a guy you can count on for basically the same offensive production almost every single season. Now, if you're projecting ahead to next year, I don't know if you feel comfortable saying, oh, this is a well above average offensive player. I would probably say that still. I think a lot of it shows, you pointed out, at what point this season have you been 100% confident he's healthy? I don't know if there's ever been that point, maybe the very beginning of the season. So it's tempting to just say, I want to throw out everything he's done this year. I want to throw it in the trash. I want to get a match, light it on fire, have one of those post-apocalyptic, you know, garbage burning barrel situation with him. But that's not necessarily how teams think. They think a lot about, as much as they're statistically inclined, as much as they like to think long-term, what they just saw was a guy who was hurt and frankly bad. that's a tough situation when you're going out to potentially try and sell this player. So you want to give other teams something else to look at. And that's something else from a trade perspective, ideally for the Blue Jays, would be him putting together a couple weeks of, oh, he can really mash the ball again. And it makes teams feel more comfortable that what they've seen for the vast majority of 2024 is a bit of a mirage, is a bit of bad luck. Because a lot of players have this. They just have a year where they're simply not healthy. The production doesn't follow.
Thomas, let's say for the sake of this conversation that Bo is not a Blue Jay next year, right? Let's just say he does get traded to Team X. They get a couple of prospects for him. Let's just say that happens in the offseason. It's going to be an interesting spot to fill for the Blue Jays, right? Because we talk about auditions for 2025 a lot. The three of us have done this at different points this year. And I think this year so far, especially in Bo's absence, we've seen a lot of Ernie Clement at shortstop. We've seen a lot of Leo Jimenez at shortstop. And Leo Jimenez, I've been pleasantly surprised by. I feel like the conversation on Ernie Clement, I'm not saying it's over by any means, because, you know, he's a little bit of an older guy. But at the same time, you do, you know, you want to see a little bit more from virtually everyone whose name is not Vladimir Guerrero Jr. But, you know, Ernie Clement, for me, I think has locked down a spot on next year's team. I don't know what that spot looks like. Like, he could be the starting third baseman. He could be a bench piece. Whatever it looks like, he is on the team next year, which is why I kind of just, like, take him out of this conversation for a brief moment. But Leo Jimenez is a fascinating player. We talked about Leo with Ben Nicholson-Smith yesterday, Nick, and it's just, I can't help but think that, you know, I'm not sure that, like, if you were going into 2025 and Leo Jimenez is your starting shortstop, if you know, if you could have had Willy Adames, for example, I'm just using an example because he hit another home run again last night. He's been on fire. But, you know, if you had the pick, most people are going to pick Willy Adames. There's no disrespect to Leo. But I do wonder how you feel about the prospect of Leo Jimenez being one of these players that takes up a spot on the 26-man active roster come, like, let's say, the end of March 2025.
Yeah, I think that's why these last 4 or 5 weeks are so important for a guy like Leo Jimenez, just because we really need to see more out of him. He's only got a 41-game sample size thus far, and he's so far been really good of late, but overall, statistically, he's been basically a league-average hitter, according to WRC+. So I really am intrigued to see what he can do moving forward. I mean, there's no replacing a player like Bo Bichette inside the organization, just what the Blue Jays have. So if it's a Willy Adames, great. Like, I'd love to see the Blue Jays go out and pursue him, even if Bo Bichette's still on the team, because that's a player that would look terrific at third base.
Sure,
even.
Yeah.
Right? So I think Leo has got a really good chance of making the team next year, depending on what happens throughout the rest of this season. But it's also important to note, too, that he's going to be out of options next year, too. So, you know, for a guy that has shown so much potential, not just this season, but in previous ones as well, you'd hate to lose a guy like that on waivers, too. So I would love to see Leo Jimenez a part of next year's team, but it really depends on what happens the rest of the way for him, both because I think defensively he's already there. Like, I think big league caliber defense is already within his grasp. It's just whether or not he can hit enough to be an everyday player.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you framed it as a member of the 26-man roster, because it's easy to see, based on his defensive skills, as Thomas alluded to, you know, he can be a utility infielder for you. If you were thinking, okay, Bo Bichette has been traded, let's slot Jimenez in as a starting shortstop, I don't see that as a viable path. There may come a day, you know, this guy's 23 years old. You never know how guys are going to develop. But as much as he's hit the ball relatively well recently and for extra bases, more than you'd expect, if you look at his minor league track record, you look at kind of the Statcast data, how hard is he actually hitting the ball? There's not a lot of power in this bat. Again, sometimes guys develop late power. We are living in a market where Jose Bautista happened. This is not going to happen with Leo Jimenez. I'm quite confident. I'm willing to put that take on the record. Leo Jimenez will not hit 50 home runs in a season. But when you don't have that power, you're so reliant on, am I putting the ball in play a ton? Am I avoiding strikeouts and giving myself an opportunity to get those line drive singles and doubles? And am I taking my walks in order to get my on base up to a respectable level? And right now he's doing neither of those things. Is a little, like, I know the overall numbers are decent, but I think the power might be a little bit unsustainable. So you're looking at a guy who needs to really cut down on strikeouts, and he needs to take some walks, which is going to be tough because he doesn't have that power deterrent, really. Pitchers are not going to be scared of this guy. So a lot of it will be cutting down on strikeouts, making sure he's consistently putting the ball in play. He can do that enough, again, to be an MLB player, to be the utility guy, and he's young enough that you never know where it goes from there. But the idea that, oh, they're going to trade Bo Bichette and then they'll slot in Jimenez, you have a solution at shortstop, I just don't see that work.
I see a text here from Andy in Peterborough. And 590-590, name and location is where you can text us certainly anytime. And, you know, as we have the discussion about Bo and potential replacements at shortstop for next season, Andy says, I prefer to see Bichette's dismal year as an aberration. He's a dedicated, hardworking, and comparatively self-effacing professional. I hope Jay's management hangs on to him, mends the necessary fences, and signs him. It may not happen, but it would be, in my opinion anyway, be wise. So that's Andy from Peterborough. So Andy, I think, leans more clearly on the side of keep Bo Bichette. It just, you know what, on the other half of this conversation, just to wrap up, like, no matter who replaces Bo next year, I've always wondered about Bo's desire to play in Toronto. And again, there's no way for anyone to, like, truly know this, to be honest, unless you are in his mind. Like, I honestly don't even really think anyone literally outside of him, like Dante Bichette, probably doesn't truly know. John Schneider probably doesn't know. Like, a lot of the people outside of Bo, it's impossible for them to really know, right? Unless, even if he goes out and says certain things to the media. So I always find it real an interesting aspect of the discussion, because it's so easy to compare Bo and Vladdy, obviously, because they're the two stars. They came up together. They were going to be the faces of the franchise for many, many years. But Vladdy has never shied away from saying, I want to play in Toronto for the rest of my life. Like, bleep the Yankees. I never want to play for them. Like, he's a pretty outgoing guy. And I know people were kind of like, oh, well, he walked it back. I think he really just did that because someone in his camp probably said something.
That's a business decision. Yeah, not a Vladdy emotional decision.
Exactly. I can't get behind the mindset that Vladdy, after years of saying that he wants to be a Blue Jay forever, suddenly just this changed his mind on a dime. I just really truly don't believe that. But with Bo, it's almost been like two things work against him. One is he's never gone out of his way to say, yeah, I want to stay in Toronto for the rest of my life. But two is he's also just, to Andy's point, he's also just like a quiet guy. Like, he's not a very effusive person, right? Like, I've had a couple of conversations with him during his tenure here. He's just like I sometimes have used the word taciturn. I know that can have somewhat negative connotation, but I really use it to mean that he just is a man of few words. He does not mince words. And I think that's not really helped him. I don't think he really sees the point in going out there and like making some kind of eloquent speech to the media being like, yeah, I love Toronto. I'm going to stay here forever. I really do think that's a large part of why. And then again, his play and the injuries and the lack of production certainly as well. But I think that's gone a long way in changing perception of him, which is probably not entirely fair, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like you said, I just don't think Bo is that type of guy like Vladdy is, where he's just going to come out and express his desire to stay in Toronto for potentially the rest of his career. And you know, I think Bo, to some degree, is just, he knows what the situation is. He knows that the team has underperformed this season. He knows himself he's underperformed. And that because of that, these rumors are going to start to circulate, whether he likes them or not. So, you know, ultimately, like, whether or not Bo wants to be here, I think that's maybe a conversation for another day. But in terms of the Blue Jays actually trading him, I just have a hard time seeing it just because of the year he had. His value has diminished so much this season. And being able to replace a player of that caliber outside of this season is just going to be so extremely challenging that I really have a hard time seeing Bo not being on this team next season.
Yeah, in terms of what you said there, Thomas, there's kind of two routes you can go into with Bo for 2025 that are both viable. Like, a lot of people kind of have this belief that, you know, I know we've heard rumors he's going to be traded, or the team's kind of done with him. He's kind of done with the team. Some of that, I think, is noise. But either, you know, you're trying to compete in 2025. He is the best shortstop you're going to have. So he helps you win games in 2025, a season where reportedly, and based on their actions in terms of not trading the Bassetts and Gausmans of the world, they're trying to compete. He helps them do that. He, you know, if he is an aberration, as our texter said, if that this season rather is an aberration for him, then he helps you do that, helps you accomplish that goal. And then you worry about the contract in the offseason. Maybe he's showing you enough that you gain more confidence in it. Maybe you can't win against another team. We'll see what happens in that situation. The second half is, if you have a disappointing year, you can evaluate whether you can trade him at the deadline, get more value for him then. The only time that burns you is if the team is bad and Bo is bad. that's a possibility. That's what happened this year, to be honest. But I think the Blue Jays would believe that one of the two things, either the team will be good enough that he'll be helping the team win, or he personally will be good enough that he can help return something better than they get in the offseason. I think that's why it probably makes the most sense to keep him going. In terms of his desire to be here, as you said, Sho, there's not a lot in terms of his words in the media, but there's so much more that goes into it. I think it's worth remembering. And I want to preface all this by saying I do not believe he will be a Blue Jay long, long term. If you had to make me bet today, is he a Blue Jay for life? I would say no. But in the draft process, he was very much interested in coming to the Blue Jays because of how he felt they would treat his process and his unorthodox swing. Also, his father was a part of the coaching staff in a sort of consulting role at times for the team. He also plays for a manager that he played for in the minor leagues and won championships with, and with teammates that he came up with, particularly Vladdy at one point, Biggio. So there are these aspects of the Blue Jays situation that have undoubtedly been kind to Bo. And the idea that he's desperate to get out, I don't think is validated by what we've seen in terms of actions or words at this point.
Bo Bichette potentially returning, I would say next week, seems like a generous interpretation of how they're trying to ramp him back up, because he was seen yesterday. He has not started running the bases yet, but he is doing some work with the team now that he has rejoined them in Boston. He was doing some rehabbing in Florida. Sounds like the plan for Bo is to get him back into a rehab assignment, perhaps on the weekend when the Blue Jays are in Minnesota. So perhaps he goes to Buffalo, wherever the Bisons might be, and then perhaps he rejoins after a couple days the Blue Jays next week. So we'll see what the ramp up looks like for one Bo Bichette. I do want to chat a little bit about the game last night, and certainly what we've seen during the win streak that's now over, I suppose, that ended at five or six games, again, depending on how you want to interpret the resumed game back on Monday. But Yariel Rodriguez was a little erratic, unfortunately, once again. Five innings, eight hits allowed, six runs, all of which were earned. One walk, three strikeouts. He threw 79 pitches, 53 of which were strikes. And I think when it comes to the starting rotation, guys, and Thomas, I'll start with you, there are a few question marks for me, kind of in two different ways you look at it. Like a question mark certainly on Bowden Francis, only because I want to see him acquit himself pretty well, and I think he's going to pitch tomorrow. So if he does end up pitching tomorrow, and if he does it against the Red Sox, that who have been honestly a pretty good lineup for most of the season, I think I'll probably be sold on him being, at least in theory, a member of the starting rotation, barring some really huge change in the offseason. But I do want to see that happen. So that's what we have to look forward to tomorrow. But Yariel Rodriguez, there's been a lot of good for him, certainly this year. There's been some bad as well. And I think last night we saw him struggle with command, you know, kind of like when he fell behind, it's almost like he tried to do a little too much. I'm curious if your opinion, Thomas, has changed on Rodriguez, because you and I have had conversations about him before. And I mean, I think we talked about him maybe around Canada Day. And then I think on Canada Day, he had maybe his best start as a Blue Jay at the Rogers Center and a very efficient start. But since then, it's been kind of a little up and down.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is just like he looks like he's running out of gas a little bit here. And like that's totally fair, given that he barely pitched at all last season and nothing after the WBC. So to me, I've been looking at his fastball velocity the last number of starts, and it's been on a gradual decline. I mean, the first pitch he threw last night was under 91 miles per hour. So like that to me, I truly think that he has the stuff to be, I don't know about a starter, but at least a big league caliber arm. I still am in the opinion of he would do a lot better as a multi-inning reliever or a high leverage reliever at the back end. But with the arsenal that he has, if he can develop it a little bit more, and now he's going to have an entire offseason to work with the Blue Jays in Florida at their player development complex. So I think he'll still have an opportunity, depending on what the Blue Jays do this winter with their starting rotation, to compete for a spot next season. But I will be really interested to see how they manage his workload down the stretch here, because it is creeping up on 100 innings pitched, and that's probably close to where the Blue Jays want to keep him at heading into 2025.
There's a couple versions of his struggles we've seen this year. And as Thomas points out, like there has been, in the game we just watched, that was a diminishment of his stuff. His fastball was coming in just above 93 miles per hour. That is a very kind of average middle of the road fastball at this point in baseball. He didn't get a single whiff with that pitch. They had 11 hard hit balls against in this game. Often when we've seen him struggle, it's been a case of he simply can't put the ball where he wants to put it. And his command was shaky in that game for sure, but he wasn't walking a ton of hitters. That has often been the problem. He's walking hitters. He's literally hitting guys. And so you thought, okay, the stuff is really dynamic, but he's not able to harness it. And that might come over time as he gets more used to being an MLB starter. Recently, the stuff hasn't looked as good. Is that a fatigue issue? It certainly could be. He's on a very extremely odd workload trajectory. Yeah. Right now. And so I'm reticent to judge what he's doing at this moment too much. I think, you know, he's coming to the end of a long season. It's been a weird process for him getting him in next year with the full spring training and getting him, you know, having a baseline of 100 or so innings is not that bad to work off of. Like, we had many discussions about Ricky Tiedemann and getting this guy to a workload that made any sense to build off whatsoever. And the Blue Jays have been unable to do that. And his future is extremely ambiguous right now. I'm not penciling in Rodriguez into the rotation for next year by any stretch of the imagination, but it's worth staying open-minded about what he can do in a more traditional situation where he has the full spring training, the preseason games. He's on a workload. He's seen MLB hitters already. Like, I could see a scenario where he doesn't necessarily break camp as a starter, but, you know, there's always injuries, there's always attrition, and he comes in and maybe looks a little bit more complete than he has, and especially in recent weeks. You know, last six starts, it's a 6.75 ERA. Like, this is problematic performance for Yariel Rodriguez. But as much as we don't want to fall too much in love with Bowden Francis based on the last few starts, I don't think we want to get too low on Rodriguez based on his recent struggles either.
Yeah, it's funny. The conversations feel very, like, they run very parallel to one another, just because Bowden Francis has, I think, played himself, in the minds of many at least, played himself into the starting rotation, while Y-Rod has played himself perhaps out of the rotation a little bit, which is kind of funny because it essentially means, if that is true, if those both those things hold until the end of September, which is possible, I suppose, if both those things become true, then you're still looking for a fifth starter next year. I think a lot of people thought that maybe Yariel Rodriguez would be the fourth starter. You go to a fifth starter in free agency, and now it might be the complete opposite, honestly. Bowden Francis might be the fourth starter, and Yariel Rodriguez might be the bullpen. And let's face it, the bullpen needs a lot of work in the offseason. We heard what Nick thought about Yariel Rodriguez to start. We heard what Thomas thought about Yariel Rodriguez. Let's hear what John Schneider thought of Yariel Rodriguez. Again, five innings allowing six earned runs. Here's the skipper after last night's game.
He settled in, you know, fairly well after that. You know, it's a, you know, kind of a get me over here to Duran, who's swinging it really well. I think, you know, what he can take out of it is you look at as you go down to Yoshida's at bat, it's a 3-1 count. You know, you want to be careful in that situation with the string of righties coming up and pitch to the situation a little bit. But I thought after the first, he was efficient. And he made good pitches. Came down to the fifth where, you know, he was at that spot where his pitch count was okay and made a couple mistakes with breaking balls.
What are your goals for him as he finishes his first goal since?
I mean, it's a fine line between keeping him stretched out and, you know, not walking him into dangerous spots, you know. So being on a routine is going to be important for him. Understanding situations of every single inning is going to be important, you know, from a physical standpoint, we want to keep him going. And at the same time, I think just kind of learning from every outing and how he can just be a little bit finer with his execution.
I found the aspect of that was really interesting was the second half of his answer, because you heard Hazel ask him the question, like, what are the goals, the motivations for the rest of the season? Because there's only probably, what, if we're being generous, make three to four more starts, depending on how it lines up for Yariel Rodriguez. Maybe one more, depending on how the season goes. But you know, I think if you're looking at the rest of the season, John Schneider is saying we don't want to walk him into dangerous spots, and it's a fine line between keeping him stretched out. And again, I think that kind of alludes to what you were talking about, Nick. You were talking about the idea of, you know, it's a workload he's never really seen before. Thomas mentioning that he is like, he's never pitched in Major League Baseball prior to this year, so he's like a true rookie in terms of being in the majors, even though he's a little older, having pitched in Japan and pitched for Cuba at the World Baseball Classic. So I just, you know, when you look at Yariel Rodriguez going forward, even just into this season, like, not even for the rotation for 2025, just for the rest of this year, I am curious how careful they will be with him, Nick, because ultimately, you know, they just, the end of the line is they need guys to throw innings. Like, they're going to try and elongate the starting rotation with this extra day of rest as much as they can. And I think they will be able to rejig things to a certain extent in September, because there are way more days off in September than there have been in the month of August. I mean, there are two days off in the first week of September alone, and there are barely any days off in the entire month. I think they had 2 days off in the whole month of August. So they'll have a chance here. But I do wonder what your expectation is for Yairo Rodriguez this season, because I do wonder if things go awry, maybe we do end up seeing like a Jake Bloss spot start at some point here.
I wouldn't be surprised if he gets kind of yanked from the rotation again, hitting some kind of innings limit. He's such a, it's bizarre sort of the trajectory of his innings, right? His career high in professional innings, this is in Cuba, 2018, 133.1. Right. So that's sort of a modern fifth starter type of workload. And then after that, he kind of rubs up against 100 innings a couple of times. Then in 2022, he's down to 54.2 innings because he's working as a reliever in Japan. Then 2023, barely any innings at all, worked at the World Baseball Classic. So I'm sure the people who are doing modeling for, you know, strain on arms in the Blue Jays front office have no idea what to do with this guy. I would say that something in that range of 90-something to 100 innings seems the most logical, because he's done that many times relatively recently, like 2020, 2021. He's been in that area before. So I think, you know, that he's comfortable there. He's, you know, he's a fully physically developed guy too. That's part of it. Sometimes when we have these young pitchers and we got to be so cautious with this guy, let's give him, you know, 3-4 innings a start, let's make sure we don't get him much over 100 for the season. Part of the reason why is because these are 19-year-olds, 20-year-old kids, and they have more to potentially develop physically. Whereas he's a full-grown man. So that's another part of it as well. There's so many aspects of this. I think that even if you had a rock solid, this is how we want to model pitchers, he's such an unusual case that there will be a little bit of them doing it by feel, because they're on uncharted territory with this dude.
Thomas, before we let you go, and we're going to be going to Will Leach from MLB.com on the other side, chat a little Hall of Fame, chat a little bit about Joey Votto. It's going to be fun. But I did want to get your take on what we could expect from the Blue Jays tonight. And the series continues. The Blue Jays are, I don't know how likely the playoff odds are, but Nick and I have discussed that, you know, getting back to 500 will certainly be viewed as an accomplishment. And tonight we are going to see Chris Bassitt. And Chris Bassitt has had, kind of like Yariel Rodriguez, if we're being honest, a bit of a topsy-turvy season. Like, I made the case to you, Thomas, I don't know if you remember this, before the All-Star break, I made the case to you that there was a good chance that Chris Bassitt could have been an All-Star. And then I think like his last start right before the All-Star break, he got hit up a little bit, and then he did not end up getting named as a reserve. But I really think that like if there were like two more spots available on the AL starting pitcher team, he might have been one of the guys. Even if he didn't see a lot of time, he might have gone to the All-Star game. That's how well he was pitching it, right? Like in early July. But less so after the All-Star break. He's had a couple of good outings, but he's been hit around a fair amount. What are you expecting from Bassitt tonight against the Red Sox lineup? Again, starting pitching has been a weakness for them, but their bats have been pretty hot, all things considered. So what are you expecting from Bassitt tonight?
So I'm going to be really intrigued to see how he fares against Boston's lefties, because we all know those are the types of hitters he gives up a lot of damage against. And, I mean, there has been a fair bit of swing and miss from Bassitt despite the poor results since the All-Star break. He had 9 strikeouts against the Orioles on August 6th. So there is some underlying positivity there with Bassitt. But at the same time, you're right. Like, there is the fact that he has been hit fairly hard over these last five, six starts here. So, you know, it will be really interesting to see how he's able to fare and whether or not, too, he gets some run support, too, behind an offense that has been slugging a lot better of late. So we'll see what happens against the Red Sox here. But I would really hope to see that Bassitt is able to go on a bit of a run here heading into the final months of September, just because he is going to be all that important to the team in 2025 as well. And you want him pitching, or at least going into the offseason, on somewhat of a positive note as well.
Nick, what are your expectations for Bassitt tonight?
I guess it's going to be a tough one. You know, Boston's lineup is pretty strong. He has struggled with home runs. We know the Red Sox can hit home runs. If you look at Bassitt's last 9 starts, it's a 680 ERA. Ooh. This is grim stuff. Like, with him, his approach from game to game is so different that it's hard to say, oh, this is exactly what Chris Bassitt's been doing, and this is what's working and not working. He's a very hard player to analyze in that respect. He'll have a different game plan for anyone he faces. So you never know when he's going to come up with that kind of brilliant game plan that totally flummoxes an opposing lineup, because that's in his bag. He's got like the 7-8 pitches to play with. But the recent evidence suggests he hasn't been able to find that, even though he's been striking some guys out. And the Red Sox lineup is no joke. They've got a lot of young players who are really raking right now.
Chris Bassitt takes the ball for the Blue Jays tonight as this five-game series continues at Fenway Park. That's Nick Ashbourne. Thomas, this was fun, man. It was nice to have you in studio. We'll have to do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me in, guys.
That is Thomas Hall from the Jays Nation. I'm Sho Ali. Nick and I will be back after the break. We'll chat with Will Leach from MLB.com. More Jays Talk Plus in a moment on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also on Sportsnet Plus and on Sportsnet 360. Hello, everyone. You're all doing well. Sho Ali, Nick Ashbourne here with you. We are filling in for one Mr. Blake Murphy, who is, in fact, back tomorrow. So you'll be graced with the dulcet tones of Blake tomorrow morning. We're being joined right now. Very pleased to be joined by Will Leach, columnist for MLB.com, as we kick off the next hour of our show. Will, how's it going?
Hey, right, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning, Will. We appreciate it, man. Thanks for carving out some time for us. And look, I wanted to get to some of the pieces you've written for MLB.com, of which there are many, and they're all a lot of fun to read. But before we do that, I did want to get your 100-foot view, let's call it, on the Blue Jays these days. And, you know, they're a team, and I was actually reading your power rankings. They're not dead last, which is certainly a nice nice change, but they've underperformed badly for much of the season, but have played well enough in the month of August to the point where I think, even with the loss last night, I think fans believe there's an outside chance for them to make the playoffs. I am less bullish, I think Nick is as well, on their playoff odds, but I do sometimes wonder if I'm somehow like caught up in the bubble here in Toronto, so I was hoping to get your take.
I would probably be where you are on their playoff chances, but I would say, there were a lot of people around baseball kind of wondering, hey, are the Blue Jays going to sell off big, right? Are they really going to sell? Are they going to trade Bland? Are they going to trade Bichette? And the fact that they didn't do that and said, we really believe this is a good team in 2025 that can compete, then I say August is an excellent test case for making that argument, right? Like, they looked pretty good this month, and I think, you know, there's a big transition coming one way or the other, whether they're going to win next year and be able to move forward, or they're going to have to make some changes after that. I think some people wanted them to do that early. I wouldn't get too excited about this year. I would say, but it's fine. Like, at a certain level, no matter what happens, it's encouraging to see a team that struggles as much as Toronto start to have things kind of come together a little bit, have some young players step forward and do stuff. I think it gives you encouragement, and it kind of makes it look like it was a good idea not to sell things off at the deadline.
Will, you led your column the other day talking about Joey Votto, his legacy, and the potential Hall of Fame case there. And while he never appeared in a Blue Jays uniform at the big league level, you know, he's from here. I think it's a case that people here are invested in. One of the things that interests me about it is that it feels like a lot of Hall of Fame discussions are really around these big round counting numbers. It's 500 home runs. It's your number of all-stars, your number of MVPs, you know, even wins above replacement is a counting stat in a sense. And sort of what made Votto's case special is, you know, it's the on-base percentage, it's the rate stats. On a per-at-bat basis, he was this incredible hitter. How do you see Votto's Hall of Fame case? And do you think that as, I don't know, the voting block becomes a little bit more sabermetrically inclined, we'll see more of these candidates who don't necessarily have that gleaming round number to point to make it to the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I think he is in excellent shape to not just get in the Hall of Fame, but probably on the first ballot. And I think a lot of that, I'm not sure that would have been the case 20 years ago with the putting up the career that he had. And I think that's not Joey Votto's fault. I think that would have been the voters' fault. I think if you can't talk about baseball in any serious way anymore and not be very well versed in this stuff and what made Joey Votto a great player. Now, listen, Joey Votto, if you watch the game, Joey Votto play a game, like, it's not like you're like, you needed to see his OBP to know that he was good. So I think sometimes it gets lost. Like, Joey Votto was a really fun player to watch play baseball, and that is a part of getting in the Hall of Fame, is being famous and seeing people a superstar. I mean, like, he was an MVP. He was an MVP at a time when we were not embracing even these statistics all that much as we are now, and he still won an MVP. So I think that Votto is, I think, having a big personality, I think, has helped him. Has actually helped almost educate a lot of older sports writers and a lot of older fans and people that weren't as well versed in this stuff to be like, okay, he's really great. So how does he only have this counting numbers and this counting numbers? Because you can tell this is a great player. And I think you were able to see that pretty much throughout his career. I do think as the voting base has gotten, I wouldn't say younger, but like more, if you're active in the sport right now, OBP and WAR are as important a statistic as RBIs were for sports writers 30 years ago or those big round numbers are. So I think those round numbers, particularly as the game changes, it's going to be a big thing in a couple of years with starting pitchers. What even makes a starting pitcher anymore? No one's going to get 300 wins in the future, and you have to decide what makes a Hall of Famer a starting pitcher. I think a guy like Votto, I think he's going to sail in, to be honest. And I think it's going to be a sign that the voting group has definitely evolved and is moving in the right direction.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. First of all, I love the Hall of Fame conversations. I think they're one of my favorite things to discuss. Maybe it's because it's a very sports talk radio thing to discuss. Certainly will. But in baseball, it's just a lot of fun. And I'm glad you guys mentioned the idea of the first ballot because, you know, on one hand, I do think it should happen. But I also wonder if it will happen, mainly because I say this with the most love and respect for the voters of the Hall of Fame in the world. But you know, they can be a little snobby sometimes, and I think I do wonder if perhaps we are there with the split between, let's say, younger voters or even a little couple guys who are a little bit older but still are more statistically inclined for some of the newer stats like WAR, for example. I don't want not newer stats, but stats that are being looked at, I suppose, differently versus like some of the older voters that might only look the lack of counting stats and not be so impressed. I just find it interesting, I suppose, because, I mean, if you're a Hall of Famer, you're a Hall of Famer. Okay, there's no special notch on your plaque at Cooperstown that denotes that you got it on the first ballot or that you were voted for 100%. Like, there's nothing about that. It's just you're either in the Hall of Fame or you're not. So I do think Joey Votto, on merit and on, like, eye test-wise, even beyond all the statistics, which he does have in large spades, he is a Hall of Famer. It's just, I find the discussion about the first ballot so interesting because he's one of those guys that I think is like, essentially like the first real modern test case for how people will view players like this.
And I think the thing that helps is, you know, you talk about young sports writers. Like, those young sports writers, by the time that Votto comes up, I mean, Moneyball will have been out for 25 years by the time that Votto gets on the ballot. You know, I mean, like, those young sports writers, I'm not getting older, but I'm told that other young sports writers are, in fact, getting older. And so, certainly, I think that's kind of the idea. It's like, the way we look at baseball players, we've been drifting away from these counting numbers for a very long time in the sort of discussion of baseball. That doesn't mean that counting numbers are not still fun. It's not still cool when someone gets a milestone. Heck, Aaron Judge got his 1,000th hit the other day, and sure, it was cool, even though 1,000 hits isn't even that impressive. Like, counting numbers are still fun, but I think that when you're looking at the totality of a career, everybody understands and have really understood for a long time that there's a lot of better metrics for you to be able to kind of understand and discuss this. And it doesn't mean that RBIs still aren't kind of fun. Like, there's a lot of guys like Aaron Judge has a ridiculous number of RBIs so far, and it's really cool. But the reason he has so many RBIs is because, oh, he hits slugging percentage is really high, and his exit velocity is so high, and he hits all these homers. Like, you don't the quality of the player, these stats support that rather than fight against it. So I think that the idea that Votto is a guy like that who really his entire career, at least after the very beginning, people have all understood this stuff. But by the end of his career, this would be a band of playing for a long time. Early in his career, Votto was seen as, he's not a clutch player. He'd rather walk and hit a three-run homer, which I'm sure he would not. I'm sure everyone would rather hit a three-run homer. But he was criticized for being so patient. You didn't really hear that about Votto at all at the end of his career. That's the advantage of playing for a long time. People eventually realize, oh, he's a genius. He's like a great baseball player. And I think people that eventually can't watch him long enough and not realize that.
But when it comes to the Hall itself, do you think it matters who gets in a particular year or who's eligible in a particular year? Like, for example, I believe Votto is eligible for the class of 2029, which also includes first-time eligible players, barring some big comeback, I suppose. It would be Miguel Cabrera, Madison Bumgarner, Nelson Cruz, Adam Wainwright. Like, there are a lot of guys that, like, a lot of relatively modern players who I think fit the bill in a lot of the similar ways of Joey Votto in terms of answering questions about how sports writers view statistics in the modern era. But a lot of guys who will be eligible, I sometimes wonder, because we've seen very small classes go into the Hall of Fame, for example. We've also seen very large classes go into the Hall of Fame. I do wonder, like, do you think that affects chances of any of those guys? Like, certainly Joey Votto included, but I do wonder if some voters don't like to use their, like, to check off all the possible boxes on a particular ballot. I wonder if that affects things in the next coming years.
Yeah, and a lot of times timing can really affect guys. I always use an example of Jim Edmonds. If you look at actually Jim Edmonds, his career WAR numbers are very much Hall of Fame worthy. He has an excellent case for the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, he retired the same year as Ken Griffey Jr. And so he was on the ballot at the same time. And so they looked at Jim Edmonds and said, well, he's great, but he's obviously Ken Griffey Jr. Right. Is the greatest center fielder of his generation. And they kind of like forgot about Edmonds and ultimately hurt him and got him off the ballot. I can see that. I have a hard time seeing how it hurts Votto too much. I think in that particular class, I think that might actually hurt Nelson Cruz a little bit, because Nelson Cruz was a good player who had a lot of those counting numbers. But no one looked at Nelson Cruz next to Joey Votto or Miguel Cabrera and could ever make the argument that he would be close to either one of them. So I think that hurts, because it is, you get back to the first ballot thing, you do think of these things strategically sometimes. You know, sometimes if you have you only go for 10 guys on your ballot. I'm a big Hall person. I would vote for 10 guys. I like a big Hall. A lot of people aren't like that. And to get that 75% threshold, there's always one or two jokers that say, I don't like any of these players, and don't vote for anyone. It drags it down for everybody. So, you know, I think it is hard to get in. I do think going in with Cabrera, who is a clear Hall of Famer as well, but in a different way than Votto, I think will actually probably help him. I think it will feel those two players are so clearly, there's some good players on the list that you're talking about, but those two players are so clearly ahead of those guys, everyone on there, that I think that ultimately will help. It helps too, because a lot of the steroid guys, thoughts about it, those guys are off the ballot now. That was a big issue for like a long time, is balancing how these votes were going to go. People are more encouraged to use more stuff in the ballot now. I think it's cleared out space first in the ballot movement.
I want to ask about a guy who's sort of on the flip side of Joey Votto. Like, if we're talking about Votto being part of a more modern group of players that's understood differently, that has a really strong case to make the hall, a guy that Sho and I were actually talking about off air the other day, who feels a little bit the opposite, is Giancarlo Stanton, someone who's approaching 500 home runs, not a guarantee to get there, but let's say he gets there. But on the flip side, you know, could easily end his career with less than 50 wins above replacement and have, you know, an end of the career that is, you know, solid but unspectacular. Maybe won't be remembered the same way as he was when, you know, kind of 2017 when he was incredible in Miami. Do you think that the voting bloc kind of changing shape and becoming prioritizing different things could prevent a guy like Stanton, who maybe in the past people would say, and again, I'm assuming he gets 500 home runs, maybe that doesn't even happen, but would just say, oh, 500 home runs, iconic slugger, Yankees, maybe out of bias, and kind of pushes him through, and maybe we'd see a player like that differently?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think a couple things are going to affect. One, the statistics that you're talking about. Two, and again, I think this is actually where some of the steroid guys comes in. That used to be an absolute 100% certain thing. When you hit 500 home runs, you might as well just cash your ticket right there. And that's now not the case. Now, again, a lot of the reasons that the primary reason that guys like Barry Bonds is the best baseball player I have ever seen in my entire life. And I find it kind of insane. The best baseball player I've ever seen in my entire life is not in the Hall of Fame. But you can understand why people did not vote for him. So there's a guy with more than 500 home runs who doesn't have one. That's not in there. Mark McGwire's not in there. Sammy Sosa's not in there. There's a lot of guys that those numbers that used to be sacrosanct, we now just don't consider them. Now, that's obviously not Giancarlo Stanton's fault. That guys hit over 500 runs but may or may not have been using porcans and drugs, people won't vote for them because of it. But I do think that, like, we've already shown that, like, oh, well, we, of course someone with 500 home runs gets in. We don't feel that way anymore. And I think that does hurt Stanton. It also hurts Stanton. You know, a lot of times the narrative, like the fact is, Stanton may end up getting to 500 home runs. I don't think anyone, and certainly not the people paying checks over at Yankee Stadium, would say, "Oh, Giancarlo Stanton maximized his career. We got everything out of him." You know, I think that there's a sense that this back half of his career has felt like this pretty big disappointment, and I think that can help it stick in voters' minds. So yeah, I do think Stanton is a very, if he gets to 500, that's going to be very, very interesting.
Will, you said earlier that you were a big Hall guy, and I think a lot of people who fit that description, and I'm going to give you this question because I know that show wants to go tiff with the last one here, so we'll do one more Hall of Fame. But people who fit that description, generally speaking, have their personal guy who is an outrage to them personally that this baseball player is not in the Hall of Fame. So I'm wondering, as someone who believes in a big haul, who is on the outside looking in that if you had the ability to wave a magic wand and put them there, who would it be?
I mean, for me, it would be Bonds, but I understand that it would be Clemens as well, but I understand that is a more controversial topic, taking away PED sort of stuff. Honestly, I really feel like my two guys are like Jim Edmonds and Lou Whitaker. Those are just like the idea that Alan Trammell was in the Hall of Fame. But Jim Edmonds, to me, you know, I think defensively, he was the best defender at the most premium defensive position in the out, other than shortstop, for a considerable period of time, and also hit 35, 40 homers every year. It was on that great 2004 Cardinals team that both Albert Pujols and Scott Rowland were also there in the Hall of Fame, and I think everyone on that team thought Edmonds was the equal of both of those guys. So I know I feel weird advocating so much for a guy who has showed up on Real Housewives shows several times. So it's a tough look for you,
I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that. But as a player, I've always thought he was a really, really underappreciated guy. And I do think him being next to Griffey really hurt him. Griffey was obviously a better player than Jim Edmonds was. So I think Jim Edmonds was the second best center fielder at that time. And I think Griffey's kind of greatness and fame kind of outshadowed him.
Will, before we let you run, as Nick alluded to, I must ask you, it'd be selfish, it's selfish of me, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about TIFF because this festival starts in a couple of days, essentially. So I am curious, are you coming to Toronto for TIFF? If you're not, is Tim Grierson, your podcast partner, coming to TIFF? And I suppose my C question is simply, what movies are you looking forward to at the Toronto International Film Festival this year?
Oh, yeah. So I will not be there. Tim, I do the Grierson Leafs podcast. Thank you for mentioning the Grierson Leafs podcast. It is a weekly movie podcast that my friend Tim will be there. He's in Venice right now, and then he's going to Toronto. So he's doing, things are going well for him right now. He's going to go from Venice to Toronto. So I'm very excited about, all the TIFF movies. I'm looking forward to David Cronenberg's movie, actually, The Shrouds. I think it's kind of based on a lot of his personal tragedy, and there's some really very good, I think it played at Cannes, very good reviews at Toronto. It's Cronenberg, it's Canada. I think he's kind of a local hero coming home. So of all the movies there, I would be most excited to see The Shrouds. And I hear it's very good and very sad, but that's probably the movie there that I would want to see.
Grierson and Leach is the name of Will and Tim's podcast, which you can find wherever you grab your favorite podcast. Certainly, Will is also a columnist for MLB.com amongst many hats he wears. Will, we appreciate you carving out some time for us this morning. We appreciate it, man, and best of luck going forward.
Thanks for letting me talk about Joey Votto. It makes me really happy.
No problem. There he goes. That's Will Leach from MLB.com. You know, I'm first of all, I'll just say this. Like, I'm a big fan of TIFF. I cannot wait for the film festival this year. So it's one of my favorite like cultural events that take place in the city every year. There are a lot of things that happen. It's a big city. It has millions of people who live here. But I think it's that one of the world's premier film festivals happen here. I think, and it's that it's accessible to so many people is really exciting for me as someone who's been going to TIFF since I was like in high school, essentially. So I'm very excited for it. I don't know how big a TIFF guy you are.
I was going to say, I'm going to disappoint you here. I've lived in Toronto my entire life. I've never attended TIFF once. I do like movies, but my strategy for TIFF, and this is partly an economic strategy to avoid spending money, is that I have two very close film buff friends.
Okay.
And so I have them serve as my scouting department. They go to TIFF, they see the movies, and then they report back to me on what I really need to be looking forward to in the months to come. So I'm okay with not being the early adopter on every movie. I'll get my scouting reports, and then I'll have that for the rest of the year and know what I need to be looking out for.
I'm actually really trying to work in the TIFF schedule into my Blue Jays schedule. There's a couple of screenings that end on Sundays at 1:30 p.m. Eastern on days where the Jays play at home. So I'm like, oh, I guess I can't make that. Unless I could suddenly transport myself from the exterior of the TIFF light box to the radio booth at the Rogers Center.
You can run it in half an hour. I believe in you.
I probably could, but I'm not sure we want to test that theory. I love the question you asked to Will about waving a magic wand and putting someone in the Hall of Fame. If it was up to you. I'm curious if you have such a player. And it's funny because we were talking about the Giancarlo Stanton Hall of Fame case. Should he get to 500 home runs? Like, if his career were to end today, this probably no, right? Like, he's probably not in the Hall of Fame. He's around 420 home runs. So he has a little bit to go, but he's been pretty healthy this year after some injury-plagued seasons in the past. So I think if he does keep up like this kind of year, even if it's not like a truly amazing, we're not talking about the Miami version of Stanton, certainly, like you mentioned, but if it keeps up for him, I think there's a good chance. My version of the answer to your question is Carlos Delgado. And again, I understand why he's not in the Hall of Fame, but I just can't help but think. And because he also fell short of the 500 home run plateau. I think he finished with 473 home runs. But I do think to myself, I don't know, I think he was just hurt by a couple of things. I think, and primarily the fact that he played for a Blue Jays team that was pretty bad. Like, he played for a Blue Jays team that did not finish very highly in the AL East, I think, for his entire career until he went to go play for the Mets and so on. So I think that definitely harmed him. But if I could wave my magic wand, I mean, Carlos Delgado, 473 home runs, an OPS of 929. He has over 1,500 ribbies. He has over 2,000 hits. His career WAR, 44.4, so not particularly high. But I just can't help but think, I'm really sour about this, Nick, but I can't help but think that if he had those exact stats and played for the Yankees, he'd be in the Hall of Fame today. Like, I can't help but think that. Even if you don't agree that he should be in the Hall of Fame, I've always thought it's at least a disservice that he fell off the ballot after just the one season.
Yeah, for me, that's a sentimental thing, right? Carlos Delgado is a player I associate with when I first started watching the Blue Jays and becoming interested in baseball overall, right? So he has had a literal effect on my life. And so I think he's been at his height. He was one of the most dangerous hitters in baseball, you know, in his 2000 season, his 2003 season. He was truly unbelievable to watch. There's something, I don't know what it is. There's something about the left-handed swing that just looks better. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of the best hitters the Blue Jays have had in recent years have been right-handed hitters like Bautista and Donaldson and even Vladdy. I know Vladdy has kind of a pretty swing, but it's sort of a, I don't know, there's a brutishness to it. I don't know. It's not his fault. It's just the way it looks. There's something about Delgado's swing that I absolutely love. To watch. So yeah, sentimentality, I would say Delgado. In terms of, you know, on an intellectual level, I it's actually the same as Will. Lou Whitaker is just silly. Like, this is a clear Hall of Fame player, and sometimes it's second baseman, the position doesn't get the respect it deserves. You see that across baseball, you know, even in the draft prospect list, you don't see a lot of second baseman there. That's a position I personally played a lot of and really liked. I think it's a heady position, so that's a player that I respect, and his numbers are 100% there. So it's one of those ones that just makes no sense to me. But yeah, in terms of the sentimentality, Delgado is truly a big part of why I'm sitting in this chair and doing what I'm doing, and he was an unbelievable player to watch.
Yeah, same goes for me, truly. Like, I think if I was making a Mount Rushmore of my favorite athletes, not just favorite Blue Jays, but favorite athletes ever that I've ever watched in any sport, I mean, like, Allen Iverson was always pretty high up there for me. I was quite enjoyed watching AI, even though he never played for a Toronto team. You know, Matt Sundin, I grew up here. I quite enjoyed Matt's playing for the Leafs. But I think Delgado actually might be number one. Like, he might be the first name on the Mount Rushmore of show's favorite athletes. So I'm totally with you. So I agree that it is certainly rooted, at least in part, in sentimentality. But I always did feel like there were some guys who stayed on the ballot for years and years and years. Like, for their entire time, you can stay on the ballot. And he stayed on it for one season. That always felt kind of wrong to me.
That aspect is 100% accurate. There's a lot of guys who survived on the ballot who had far worse careers in Delgado, and it did seem unfair that he got booted so quickly. I will say that on my Mount Rushmore, I'd have to have Halliday potentially Delgado.
Yeah, yeah.
And weirdly, my first favorite Blue Jays player, and this is just, you know, me being a kid, not that he's a terrible player, but my first favorite Blue Jays player was Raul Mondesi.
Oh, okay, all right.
I really loved the way that he swung at everything, tried to get doubles out of singles. He had a gun in the outfield. He was really fun to watch. Not a remarkably good player at that point in his career, but an absolute treat to watch.
Just to wrap up on the Hall of Fame conversation, I did want to, because we didn't get to this with Will, but I wanted to talk very briefly about the Hall of Fame ballot that's going to be incoming for next year and a lot of the top newcomers. So Ichiro Suzuki, CeCe Sabathia, Dustin Pedroia, Ian Kinsler, Felix Hernandez, King Felix, Troy Tulowitzki, as Blue Jays fans know him pretty well, Ben Zobrist, former World Series MVP Ben Zobrist, Russell Martin, Brian McCann. Like, these are all guys that could, in theory, be in the Hall of Fame next season. And, I mean, as we know, not all, I would say very few of those guys are going to be in the Hall of Fame. There's some holdovers as well, Billy Wagner, Carlos Beltran, Andrew Jones. Like, there are a lot of names that both newcomers to the ballot, guys that have been on the ballot for quite some time. If I had to pick, I mean, it's for Ichiro, it's not a question of if he's going to get into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. It's a question of, will he become the second unanimous Hall of Famer in the history of the sport? So that's a done deal. Suzuki's in there. I'm like reasonably certain CeCe Sabathia is getting in on the first ballot. The guy has all the credentials, the counting stats. He's won championships. Like, this, he played for the Yankees. I think like that helps certainly, but I think he's also in there. I'm not really sure about anyone else. Like, King Felix, big fan of his over the course of his career, but I almost feel like it was like a prime case of like Hall of very good, but I could see some of the modern statistics, part of that conversation we had with Will, being a little kinder to King Felix. I'm not so sure, as much as I enjoyed watching Tulo and Russell Martin, I'm not sure if they're Hall of Famers. Dustin Pedroia, similarly, maybe just because of the injuries, like his career was kind of cut short. I do think Billy Wagner will get in. I think this is his final year, but he was so close last year with the vote requirement. I think he was like 2% short. So I think he probably also gets in, but I'm curious if you view it any differently.
I mean, with Will Wagner up, maybe he'll be more salient in the public consciousness.
He has been on Sportsnet a lot more recently.
Yeah, exactly. It's a press tour. This was actually his plan all along, was to train his son up to get him a little bit more press. Now, I like Wagner a lot. He was incredible in the role he was put forward. And you have to keep in mind that a lot of relievers are there because they're, quote unquote, not good enough to be starters. But you couldn't have asked anything more of Wagner. Now, he's an iconic reliever, one of the very best. I would have Wagner in there. There's a lot of, as you said, kind of Hall of very good guys for me in that mix. Andrew Jones is an interesting one to me because he's truly one of the best defensive outfielders ever to play, and sometimes that doesn't get appreciated enough, and his career ended on sort of a sour note. But if you look at him kind of the first sort of 10 years of his career, truly unbelievable, undoubtedly at that level. I would be surprised if he gets in, but he's one of the ones where I think maybe deserves a little bit more of a nudge than he's going to get.
Yeah, I think he might be, like, of the names I listed, I'm not sure there's anyone I would put over Andrew Jones. Like, I'm not sure if I'm putting Ben Zobrist, great, maybe one of the best utility men of all time, but I'm not sure I'm putting him over Andrew Jones. I'm not sure I'm putting Pedroia or even Ian Kinsler, who I did enjoy watching as well. I'm not sure they're slam dunks. I mean, I'm not sure any of them are slam dunks for the Hall of Fame, to be honest. But I think if you had to pick one to go next to Suzuki, Sabathia, Billy Wagner, I probably would pick Jones first.
Yeah, I think that would be the guy. Yeah, Zobrist, again, great career. Pedroia, great career. Maybe, you know, growing up in a market that is very much not Boston biases us against him. I'm sure there's a lot of people in Boston who think he's a Hall of Famer. But yeah, I think Jones is a pick. He's truly a superlative guy in that aspect of defense, and also a really great power hitter for much of his career as well.
That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network, watching on Sportsnet Plus and Sportsnet 360. Let's take a quick break, Nick. And when we come back, certainly go to the text line, 590-590, name and location. There are a few texts we haven't gotten to. And certainly as well, I wanted to chat a little bit with you about the curious case of Dalton Varsho. The Blue Jays did lose last night, but he did jack an absolute monster home run last night in Boston. So we'll talk a little bit about him as well. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus, watching it on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
back to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. You're also watching it on Sportsnet Plus and Sportsnet 360. Show Adley and Nick Ashbourne here with you. Final segment of the program here, Nick. Our final segment of the week until Jays Talk. We're doing Jays Talk Classic, let's call it, on the weekend. But our final segment, filling in for Blake, who is back tomorrow. So again, you'll hear Mr. Blake Murphy tomorrow morning starting at 10 a.m. Eastern. 590-590 is the text line. Standard data and messaging rates may apply. That's the people's text line, and you can certainly weigh in on anything we've been talking about. We talked a lot about Bo Bichette today, talked about Yariel Rodriguez, the starting rotation, Chris Bassett, the Hall of Fame, Carlos Delgado.
Tiff.
We talked about, you want to talk about Tiff. Hey, you're certainly more than welcome to at 590, 590. Actually, I see a text here. You mentioned Raul Mondesi. Robin Peterborough, says, I'll always remember him for his steal of home base and the way he always hustled. So it's kind of funny because that is some of the earliest memories I have of Raul as well when I think, when you mention him, certainly just now.
Yeah, that does pop to mind. And I think it kind of goes to show too, sometimes the way we consume baseball as we become deeper and deeper into it, right? Like when I was a kid and I was watching Raul Mondesi, I'm like, this guy's exciting. He's swinging, he's running, he's doing stuff. And therefore I thought, this must be an incredible player.
Yeah.
And then you look back on it and, you know, he was also not walking, striking out too much, being too aggressive on the base paths, getting caught too much, making some errant throws. Like, I don't know, he was way more fun than he was actually good. Again, at that point in his career, because he'd been much better earlier on. But sometimes it's fun to just absorb a player for what they bring aesthetically. And he brought a lot to the field in that regard, even though he wasn't a superstar at the Blue Jays.
I see a text here from Joe in Cornwall, and Joe says, Cornwall, Ontario, not elsewhere, but Joe says, be careful trading Bo or running him out of town. History tends to repeat itself. Larry Murphy and now Mitch Marner, nothing has changed. And I bring this up because I know you're particularly well-versed in the Leafs. Nick, for those who don't know, writes about the Leafs for The Athletic and a few other places as well, Maple Leafs Hot Stove, which I'm looking forward to. But it is kind of funny because I think in a lot of ways, the Bo conversation, at least here in this city, because I know like the Jays are a national team in a very large sense. So, you know, I'm sure there are many, probably millions of Jays fans who are not also Leafs fans. But as we are here in Toronto, I do find that the Bo conversation in some way parallels that of the Mitch Marner conversation that we've been having for what, like a, I mean, I was going to say a year, but it actually feels like much longer than a year with Mitch. It's just kind of interesting how, like, to Joe's point, history does tend to be a little cyclical, Nick.
Sometimes in this town, I do believe for whatever reason, I don't know if it's unique to Toronto, but I do think that these guys who are gritty and have show effort and aren't necessarily the most skilled get lionized. Like we see that in baseball. And, you know, I think of John McDonald as a great example of the Blue Jays, but you see that in hockey as well. And so sometimes when you have these guys who are sort of, I don't know, more pure skill guys, for lack of a better term, like Mitch Marner and Bo Bichette is that in a sense, not to say that he doesn't hustle, but you know what I mean? Like they are credited for being incredibly skilled. Sometimes those players are less liked for whatever reason. I think that Bichette, partly because, you know, this has been such a lost year, partly because, as we talked about earlier on the show, he's not very expressive with the fans, with the media. And so people can kind of fill in the gaps with him. When people don't speak that much, that allows the fan base or allows the media to sort of fill in based on their own assumptions and their own biases, what's going on in the player's mind, what they're like. And so you get some of that with Bo. Running him out of town, I don't think that's what's happening. I think there's a difference between running a guy out of town and not being willing to match an exorbitant price on an extension, right? I don't think the Blue Jays are trading, if they do trade Bo Bichette.
Sure.
I don't think the Blue Jays are trading Bo Bichette because they're like, Bo Bichette's a toxic personality. We got to get rid of this guy.
Right.
Or like, this is a player even that they don't believe in. They might still believe in him and think the best way forward would be to trade him because they don't see an extension happening. With Marner, I do think that there's an aspect of people really don't like having Mitch Marner around, fairly or unfairly. And so there's, you know, there's shades of gray in conversations like this.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's funny you mentioned the media, just because I've always found, as talented as Mitch Marner is, I have always found that he has been, what's the right word? I don't want to say like bad with the media, but he has certainly been like maybe like combative at best sometimes with the media. And again, I don't think it's his fault all the time, but maybe it's also because of the way, especially in Canada, this is not just a Toronto thing, but especially in Canada, how you've watched hockey players interact with the media, just like overall, they're, you know, they're almost like trained from the time they can wear skates to like say nothing of substance. And then, you know, when people do see something interesting, they get cratered for it. So I can kind of understand it, but it is kind of funny because I almost feel like Mitch and Bo are almost diametrically opposed in how they talk to the media because Bo barely does it. And when he does do it, he gives like 3-word answers. When Mitch does it, he talks a little bit more, but it's always not the tone or the tenor of those conversations are not the most positive ones.
Yeah. When the narrative sours on a guy, it's easy for people to find what the avenue of attack is, right? With Bo Bichette, oh, he doesn't say much. He doesn't care enough. He doesn't want to be in the city. He's never expressed it like Vladdy. Right. With Mitch, it's like, oh, he cares too much. He's too desperate to be in the city. Like, everything gets to him. He needs to shut the world out. And so if Mitch acted like Bo and Bo acted like Mitch, maybe everybody would be happy.
Sure.
But I think the reality is that when players don't perform or have various struggles, people find reasons to turn against them. And you can use almost any person. Like, I'll take Vladdy. He's a great example, right? Vladdy is effusive in terms of joy. Like, it just pours out of him. He's so much fun. But when he's not performing well, people say, oh, he's not taking the game seriously. He really needs to buckle down. But then, you know, look how well he's performing this year, and he's kind of as wild and having as much fun as ever. He has explicitly said that him having fun is tied to him performing well. But if he's performing well, he's fun. He's a face of the franchise. He's perfect. You got to commit to him long term. If he's not performing well, we got to stop that fun. We got to get rid of Teoscar Hernandez and Lourdes Gurriel. It's just performance dictates how people feel, and then they build the rest of the narrative around it.
I see a text here from Carmine and Vaughn. Carmine saying, it's not that these players aren't great. It's because the mix hasn't worked. So sometimes you make a trade to change the mix. And I mean, to Carmine's point, I think that could apply to either Bo or Marner, to be honest. But I will be interesting to see what the saga for both of these guys, how it ends, let's say. I tend to believe that both of them will be on their respective teams come next season, if only because I truly don't think, even if, let's say Bo doesn't, and again, I've used the word rehabilitate, if he doesn't rehabilitate his, like, I don't want to say image again, because it's not about image in terms of like a superficial sense, it's about his production on the field, but if he doesn't rehabilitate how other teams view him, then I wonder if they're just not going to be willing to give the Blue Jays what they want in a trade. And if that's the case, then I don't see the point of trading Bo for pennies on the dollar. Like, he's not that kind of player. Like, he's not a bubble player where you're just trading him like just to trade him. Because like you said,
he's not Justin Turner at this year's trade deadline.
Yeah, he's not a toxic personality. He's just, maybe he just wants out, or maybe he just has one foot out the door. Whatever that might be, he's still a very talented player. So if that's the case, I don't think you trade him like just to trade the guy. So if that's the case, then I think he's probably going to be on the team next year. Mitch Marner is under contract for next year, so it's a bit of a different conversation. But I find the way this will all conclude, Nick, just to put a bow on it, put a pin in it, is going to be fascinating, because we're going to talk. I promise you, we look for storylines to talk about post trade deadline. The team has been surprisingly fun, which has been a nice bonus. But this is going to be something we talk about between now and not even the end of September, like until the beginning of next year, essentially.
Yeah, I have no doubt. I do push back a little bit on the idea that there is a mix that has to be perfect, has to be found. I think that's much more of a hockey idea, because on the ice, people are literally working together, right? Mitch Marner is interacting with Austin Matthews, Matthew Nyes, whoever's on that line. And sometimes you can have talented players, but they don't. The way their games work just is not complementary. Sure. In baseball, the guys are largely contributing on an individual level together. So it's hard to say, oh, you know, Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. do not work together, because they're generally speaking working independently. You can come up with a couple of ones, right? If you have a really bad shortstop and a really bad third baseman, maybe you're like, this side of the infield is giving up too many outs and the other guy can't cover for one another. But most of the time, you know, you can have serious interpersonal issues in a clubhouse, things like that happen. But for the most part, baseball is more so about accumulating talent than finding the exact right chemistry.
Steph from Ottawa texts in to say, do you guys believe we have a chance of keeping both Bo and Vladdy and bringing in Juan Soto? I'm going to go out on a limb and say no. Only because I think let's just play that scenario out, right? If you were to keep both of Bo and Vladdy and sign Juan Soto, you are, in theory, if they're all getting what they want. You're handing out well over $1 billion in contracts to essentially three guys, right? Like Vladdy and Juan Soto might approach $1 billion, just the two of them by themselves. If you think that Vladdy's going to get $350 million and Soto is going to get $600 million, that's $950 million right there, which is that's a lot of cheddar. So I'm going to go on a limb and say that no, but I don't think that necessarily means that the Jays aren't going to spend money in free agency or that they're not going to give Vladimir Guerrero Jr. an extension. I think we have seen that they are ready to spend lots of dollars, but I'm not sure it's going to be on all three of Bo, Vladdy, and Soto. I mean, if you were to ask me what the most likely aspect of it would simply just be re-signing Vladdy to a long-term extension. I said this to you before. I do think there will be a conversation with Juan Soto. I really do believe that. Like, I think there will be a legitimate offer made, and I think they will actually give him a contract to sign. Whether or not he signs it, I feel like that's probably less likely, but I would be astonished if they didn't actually try. Having said that, it seems also pretty likely Juan Soto is going to end up playing for the Yankees or Mets next year.
If you're Juan Soto's agent, it would be negligent to not take the meeting or take the offer from the Blue Jays. Like, the Blue Jays are one of the higher spending teams in all of baseball. So, you know, they're not at the very, very top. He's probably going to end up with one of those teams that's at the very, very top of that pyramid.
As long as it's not the Dodgers and we have to talk about deferred money again for a whole offseason, I would vastly prefer that not happen.
That is a tiring conversation. It's funny because our guest earlier in the show, Will, he recently wrote a piece about here are the best players at every single age, from age 20 to age 40. The two best players at age 25, Soto, runner-up Vladdy. So if you, in theory, were able to pull that off, you'd be getting the two best players in the league at their absolute prime. Like, that'd be an incredible proposition, but realistically, no one is affording that. And then you throw Bo into the mix. It becomes a bit of a fantasy, unfortunately, for the Blue Jays.
I do wonder how easy, and it was the flip side of this, how difficult it would be to thread the needle when it comes to free agency for the Blue Jays this season, because in theory, right, you would be able to sell free agents, whether it's Juan Soto or like literally anyone else, right? Like, whether it's I don't think a former Blue Jays need a lot of selling. Like, I don't think the Blue Jays would need to sell Danny Jansen or Teoscar Hernandez a lot on coming back here just because they've played here for a long time. So it would really just be about dollars and years and term and so on that makes sense for those two guys in particular. So you leave them out of this conversation and you look at guys who have never played in Toronto before, like, or at least for the Blue Jays, I should say, like an Anthony Santander, a Willy Adames, an Alex Bregman, whoever it might be. And I can't help but think it would be easier, Pete Alonso, it would be easier to sell them on what they should look at going forward for their own careers beyond just money, although I'm sure money is always the primary ruler of how they make decisions. I just can't help but think that it would be easier to sell anyone on coming to the Jays if they do it with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. under contract. Because if he's not under contract, if the offer was similar from Team X and the Blue Jays, and Vladdy wasn't under contract, and the other teams have, like, if not similar players, because Vladdy's probably like one of a very few players who could do what he does. But it, you know, if you're not certain about the future of this team, then I just feel like it would make more sense to sign with another team if he wasn't under contract.
Yeah, I'm going to role play as a second, as a very slightly less talented Juan Soto.
Okay.
Purely as a hitter, too. And if I'm looking at the Blue Jays, I see a team where after the 2025 season, Vladdy, Bo, Chris Bassett potentially walk. Chad Green as well. I don't think he's really considering it down to the bullpen.
You can count him to that.
And then the season after that, potentially Kirk, Varsho, Gausman. That is a lot of uncertainty. If I'm signing a contract that is 10 years, whatever it's going to be with Soto, after 2 years, like, the majority of the above average MLB players on this team are potentially going to be gone. It's not a guarantee they're all going to be gone.
Sure.
But I don't have any certainty there. I'm approaching year three. I'm still in the beginning of my contract. Everyone has fled, and we know the Blue Jays farm system is charitably fine, maybe, like, below average. So it's not like I'm going to a team where, you know, say the Red Sox, who they're playing right now. Like, I'm going to a team where the Red Sox could say, yeah, we've got guys coming on the books, but look at these guys at AAA we're bringing across. These are some of the best prospects in baseball. If you come to the Blue Jays, the good players are, generally speaking, on the MLB roster. And so having a little bit of certainty with Vladdy, at least as a lineup centerpiece of, yes, this is at least one player that we are building around. He is a world-class hitter. Come hit in front of him, hit behind him, however you want to do that. And Soto in front of Vladdy would look really good. that would make a lot more sense. Is that going to be the factor? So it depends on the player. Some players are extremely competition oriented. Some players really want top dollar or top term, whatever. Like, it varies by player, it varies by agent. It's hard to speculate. But if you are pitching the Blue Jays without Vladdy signed, a player knows, even if they are trying to compete in the short term, even the medium term is extremely murky with Toronto.
I find it really interesting because the conversation on Soto is very similar to that of Vladdy, because they're both becoming free agents, for both being such talented players at such a young age, right? So you mentioned the age, Soto and Vladdy, both 25 years old. I mean, there's a real chance. Because we don't know how much term Soto wants. We know he wants around $600 million. I mean, if he wants $600 million, I feel like by default, the term has to be longer, because unless you're paying him, I don't know, like $120 million a year or something like that, right? But I do wonder if there's a world in which he signs like a 5 to 6 year deal to get him to free agency again by 30, 31 years old, when he could probably cash in even more. It's an unprecedented situation for someone who is this talented. So I'm curious to see what happens. We got a couple minutes left here, Nick. And tonight it will be game 4 of 5 between the Blue Jays down at Fenway Park, really like 3 of 4, depending on how you view the resumed game. Although I am kind of looking forward to leaving the oddities of the resumed game in the rear view. It was cool for like 24 hours, and now I think I'm ready to leave it behind
me. Yeah, I'm done with time travel. I'm good on it.
Me too. I think the idea of like looking up when Will Wagner's MLB debut was is going to be very, very weird going forward, I think, on Baseball Reference. But tonight will be another game between the Blue Jays and Red Sox at Fenway Park. The Blue Jays did lose last night 6-3. But Dalton Varsho ended that game. He was the second last batter of the game and absolutely jacked a home run off of, talking about the Hall of Fame, perhaps someone who probably is headed to the Hall of Fame, and Kenley Jansen. So it was a monster home run. I think it was around 420 feet, came off the bat well over 100 miles an hour. Dalton Varsho, I wanted to pick on him a little bit just because he is a fascinating player. You mentioned he's on the team for a couple more years. I think that was a big part of the attraction with him. But, I mean, I do wonder, when it comes to Varsho's place in this lineup, how much more the Blue Jays can withstand the batting. Because you know what you're getting from Varsho defensively. It's like a gold glove, maybe platinum glove level outfielder. But at the same time, the bat leaves a little bit to be desired, despite the fact that you've seen these like tantalizing glimpses of someone who has some real power.
Yeah, the floor with him is so high because he gives you that defense. You can run him out. The Blue Jays are sort of familiar with this concept. They had Kevin Pillar in town, and he was consistently a below-average hitter, but he earned his place as a starter because of what he did with the glove. Varsho is exactly the same way, but with a little bit more offensive potential, I think, than Pillar generally had. And so right now, he's in the middle, I think, quite quietly of a very strong streak, because he's not one of those young guys who's making headlines,
right?
And he's not Vladdy, who has just been unbelievable. So he's living in this middle zone. But his numbers on the season is on bases over 300. That's a big threshold for him. Sometimes he struggles to get there. His slugging is well over 400 at this point as well. He's been an above average MLB hitter. So you take a platinum glove, as you say, caliber outfielder, one of the very best defenders at any position in the entire major leagues, and you throw a bat on there that is even average, and you've got almost an all-star caliber player. And that was the vision for Varsho when they brought him in.
Right.
He had been about that. He didn't do that in 2023, but with Arizona, he had done that. He was like a slightly above average hitter, unbelievable defender. So now they're seeing that again from his bat. And in August, you know, he's got an on base of 385. Like, that's really strong, a slugging of 481. And his strikeouts have really cut down, which is huge, because sometimes he lives in the sort of high 20% strikeout range. That makes it really hard for his offensive profile to work, because his power is more good than amazing. He's brought that down. He's putting the ball in play. That was a really impressive hit. And I think going forward, if you can project him as that average hitter, maybe a hair above average hitter, I think most projection systems actually do see him that way. He's a star for the Blue Jays, and he might be a star who hits seventh or eighth in your lineup.
Right.
I don't think he's someone you want to be second, which was where he's been living a lot these days, but he can be a star that is, you know, not only provides a strong value. Also really fun to watch, like just a fun outfielder to watch, makes a lot of eye-popping plays. And you know, I don't think the Blue Jays necessarily want to do that deal with Gabriel Moreno again. I think they might be happier to have Moreno in-house. But a lot of people thought this was a disaster because they saw kind of the worst of Varsho in 2023. And now we're beginning to see it's more balanced. The picture isn't necessarily equal sides, but I don't think the Diamondbacks are going to say it when it's all said and done that they absolutely robbed the Blue Jays, because Varsho has been that good this year. And I think over the next couple of years, he'll probably be around what we've seen this year as well.
Yeah, because I think if you were getting a below average hitter in Varsho, which the Blue Jays have gotten for the majority of the season, then I think you can truly live with that if you're getting the elite production from him defensively. It's just that you can't live with it if he, like, you can do it if he's the only guy in the lineup or one of two guys in the lineup max who are giving you that kind of production on offense. The problem for the Blue Jays is that for a vast majority of the season, it's been more than half the lineup who's been giving you similar-ish production. Now, things, as we talked about, have somewhat turned. Like, the worm has turned to a very small, slight degree when it comes to the vibes and certainly the offensive production. Yeah, last night they only scored 3 runs, but generally speaking, since the All-Star break, they've looked a lot better, Nick.
Yeah, across the board. And it's not just Varsho. It's the young kids. It's Loperfido. Barger has started to hit for quite a bit of power, seeing him in the middle of the lineup. Will Wagner, I'd still describe myself as a bit of a skeptic, but the production is hard to argue with. Even Spencer Horwitz, who struggled quite a bit in kind of late July, early August, he's come around as well. There have been times this year where it felt like there really wasn't a great reason to tune in to the Toronto Blue Jays, and I think that's changed.
You can certainly tune into them tonight. Game 4 of 5 in Boston goes 7:10 p.m. Eastern, 4:10 Pacific. Dan Shulman, Buck Martinez on TV, Ben Shulman, and Chris LaRue on the radio. Blair and Barker have Jays Talk Classic after this game. We have Jays Talk Classic on the weekend, but this was fun, Nick.
Yeah, this was fantastic. It would be more of a soulful goodbye if I wasn't going to see you again over the weekend.
I will see you on the weekend. That is Nick Ashbourne. I'm Sho Ali. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to Jen, Austin, Ahmed. Blake Murphy's back tomorrow with more Jays Talk Plus. Talk to you later.